Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. Do you use any fundamental analysis?
No, zero.
Zero.
But zero. But I will tell you this much, after doing this for as long as I have, my positions start to tell you the story, or more accurately, they tell you when the story is right. You know, for example, in 98, we had the big too much stuff and the deflationary spiral. Brent crude hit 995, gold traded down to 280. I mean, these are pretty preposterous levels when you look at them now, but you know, they happened, and you know, I was participating in some of those moves at the time. So if you step back and take a look at your positions, they will tell you the story. And you know, it is nice when you know the story, but even if you know the story, you need a timing mechanism to get you in at the right time. I'll say in quotes, at the right time.
Bingo.
So you know, there's the right time, and then there's every other time. And you know, if you have better information, you know, it doesn't help if no one else knows it. You know, in fact, I argue it could hurt you if you knew it. One of the thought experiments I like to give people is, and I'll go back to the 98 crisis. If I told people the closing print in the S&P, I'll bet you they lose money. I'm telling you, I'm going to tell you the closing print, like it's January 1. And as God is my witness, this is going to be December 31st closing print. And you know, good luck. So, you know, it would happen, right? They would get levered up and they would start to get cold feet. What I didn't tell you was it was going to be down upwards of 25%-ish around October 15th of 98. And then they would close, you know, up, I don't know, it was up 5-10% on the year at the close of the year. But then you take a look and it was all eight stocks. It was just the great eight stocks that did all of the heavy lifting. So there's many ways to mess this up. You could have gotten over levered early. You could have been shaken out in the October move. And that, there's just so many ways that you could have messed it up that I just guarantee you people would not make money even if they knew the closing print. That's just this is a thought experiment we like to do.
Execution is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Along the way, I also had to change my strategy. And a lot of people know me. I was a heavy-duty scalper for a lot of years. You know, I mean, it was nothing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was nothing for me to, you know, come in and have, you know, 200 minis on in the first, you know, few minutes of the day, at least, and you know, and more.
And hold them how long?
Just scalping in and out. I mean, I would trade several thousand contracts for many, many, many years. I did that. And I just couldn't do that anymore because I felt, number one, I had fear that my health was going to deteriorate. I was not making as much money as I used to, and the amount of stress it was causing me was just not worth it. It was not worth the reward at that
point.
So I started to take the skills that I had, and I slowly had to go through a change of strategy and still be who I was, but find a way that I was more comfortable with, not going to be active all day long. I didn't need to trade that big anymore. And I really, to be honest with you, I'm the first to admit, I wasn't making nearly the money I was before. A lot of it was spinning my wheels. So it was almost a wake-up call to help me make that transformation anyway, because as a scalper, I did great for a lot of years. It's who I was. 15 plus years, it was all I did. And it took me a couple of years to kind of get away from it and just scalping less, and just I felt maybe getting a stronger hand in the market. And I had to go through 2 or 3 years of really not doing much in terms of, you know, P&L to kind of like figure it out again. And there you go. You know, and eventually now I'm like,
You wouldn't have done that if it weren't for the wake up call of a heart attack at 36.
No, because I'm stubborn. Because I felt that that's the way I made money all those years. Size was going to be the way I made money. That's the way I made money by just getting into to bigger positions. You know, I was a moments guy. You know, markets would be slow. I'd scalp small. Moments would be busy. I would trade big, scalp big, hold around a big core position. And that's just who I was, you know, and I would go at it really hard all the time. What are some of the basic essentials you believe a trader has to have set in their life as a person and also as a trader to help them deal with this pressure and help them get on the right path for success?
Yeah. So I say, you gotta have a couple key components and, you know, there's a lot of talk about these morning routines. People talk a lot about morning routines, and I talk about them too. But I say, you know, you got to have a good starting point to your day that you're not compromising. And it should involve, you know, hydrating your system, fueling your system, and then it has to address the overall, you know, muscular system and cardiovascular system. So I like to have everybody start their day with proper fueling, proper hydration, and a good stretching and activation routine. That's how I get all my guys that I coach to start their day. And that's where we start. We begin right there. Because again, much like an athlete, you got to get your system ready. You got to get your mindset ready. You got to be ready to go. And that's where I start with all my guys. And I say the reason I do that is because you got to put yourself first. A lot of your day, you may feel like you're reacting to different things, but if we could put one pillar in the ground and we start here with your own health and wellness, we've made our priority that, which is us and our own health. So we prioritize our health first, then we go to battle for the day. And then when you get home from your day of battle, I create what I call a transition routine where you say, hey, battle's ended. Now I get to start my personal life again. So we do a transition. And that's based on, I got one guy that's a musician. He's a drummer. So when he gets home, he changes out of his suit and tie, puts on his chill clothes, and he goes and drums for about 20 to 30 minutes. And that's his segue between work and personal. And then again, because the day, especially as a trader, you're charged up. You're in kill mode. You know, you're playing that offense. And then we put together a nice pre-bed routine, which for our guys, some guys, you know, they do hot baths and things like that. Same thing we do with our athletes. We're downshifting the nervous system. So in the morning, we turn you on. But as soon as that day ends, boom, we turn you off and we downshift you to where you could rest and recover and quiet your mind. Now, when I talk about training and exercise, again, the typical, you know, Wall Street mentality is, you know, go hard. I should always be going hard. Hard, 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 push, push, push. That's the mentality. So but I also teach guys, you got to know what's going on in your body. When you feel that pressure, when you feel that stress, the worst thing you could do is an aggressive, like boot camp, high intensity workout, because your body's already overly excited. You should be pulling it back down. On days you feel great, you can go for it. But days when you're charged up and your body's feeling that pressure and that squeeze, and you just feel that, like, I can't come down. The worst thing you could do is go train hard. That the best thing you can do is, you know, steam, sauna, massage, something like that. So when I build routines, it's totally custom based on the player involved. Again, my job was to oversee $300+ million in human capital, and I needed to make sure that capital was deployed when it was deployed every day, that it was ready to play. Every day it wasn't on the field was very, very costly to the organization that I represented in the Yankees. So I approach everybody as an individual. My morning routine and your morning routine may be totally different. My transition, your transition, different. Night routine, different. But I put those in place, those three pillars, morning, transition, and night, because those are the three grounding foundational steps that I believe need to be in place for you to have long-term sustainability.
The financial transaction tax.
And you just recently wrote an op-ed about this in the Financial Times. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So there are a number of lawmakers that have continued to reintroduce the retirement tax each year. Bernie Sanders has reintroduced it each year. Keith Ellison in the House has reintroduced it, and now AOC as well. And these taxes fundamentally would, you know, impact the retirement community. Some of the proposals have a tax as high as 50 basis points on the sale of securities, and you're seeing half a basis point on derivatives, which definitely impacts the futures industry, and 10 basis points on bonds. So these are not, you know, small numbers, and collectively they add up to a large, you know, burden on end users.
Yeah, those numbers are big. And what I'm curious about is, you name some of the people that are proposing this. How many people besides them are really looking at this as going, hey, this is something that could pass?
So I think so far we haven't seen that much Republican support for a retirement tax. When you look at the Democrats on the financial services and tax writing committees, you haven't seen mainstream buy-in so far. It's been mostly, I'd say, individuals who are invested in this idea of you know, having a tax proposal to pay for, let's say, social benefit programs like free college or otherwise. However, I do sense that there is greater traction, you know, gaining as we see the Green Deal come out and AOC, you know, come out in favor of this as well. So largely the people who've supported it have been those who maybe don't have a financial services background and may not totally be aware yet of the negative impact that this proposal would have on their very own constituents.
For everybody out there listening, probably thinking to themselves, Anthony, how does this directly impact the futures industry?
Well, I think, you know, when you have a tax that is imposed on derivatives, you're going to be, you know, taxing futures as well. And you've got the bond trading tax and equities tax. So anyone who's, you know, trading across different asset classes is going to bear the weight of this. You know, and also when you look at the jurisdictions in which a financial transaction tax has been embraced, you see a very negative history. In Sweden, they had a financial transaction tax briefly. It reduced the trading by 50%. The trading just went elsewhere. So I think if you're a futures trader and you want a healthy, vibrant market, you know, you don't want that trading flowing to another jurisdiction. It just limits your opportunities, and it would have a very negative impact.
Now, talk directly to those mom and pop investors out there and how this would directly impact them.
So, I mean, if you're a mom and pop investor and you are, let's say, like a teacher or a fireman who's counting on your pension fund to pay for your retirement, Modern Markets Initiative did conduct a study in the past year that's on our website. But we've analyzed a variety of state and federal pension funds. So as far as the mom and pop investor impact, we found one city employee fund from New York with about $150 billion of assets under management. Now the financial transaction tax burden was $1.3 billion a year. That's over $1 billion a year for one state pension fund. And then you can run the gamut. You know, there's another state pension fund that had $300 billion assets under management that would owe $200 million. It's really, you know, how those investments are apportioned, whether they're actively managed or more passively managed assets, and what the turnover rate.
You know what, Tim? What's really interesting to me is the micros. CME just put out an announcement that the micros are coming in May. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's an exciting time here at CME for the market and for our customers. As you saw earlier this week, we announced the launch of the Micro E-Mini Equity Index Futures at CME Group, where in May of 2019, we will be introducing contracts on the Micro S&P 500, the Micro NASDAQ 100, the Micro Russell 2000, and the Micro Dow. So truly an exciting time. And what really excites me about it and what's exciting people here down at Boca is this really will provide a more accessible on-ramp for the active individual trader to trade global equity index products at CME Group.
So to me, it sounds like there was demand for this, obviously, right? I mean, you're not going to put a product out that there's not demand for, but I guess I'm curious about the process. How did this all come about? Why did you guys sit down and say, you know what, let's create micros for these products?
Yeah, it's a great question. And at CME, we're very focused on customer demand-driven product innovation and product development. And I think micro e-mini futures are just another example of that in recent years. So when we look at the customer demand, it really came from a few different areas of the equity ecosystem, and mainly the active individual trader who was looking to trade either more futures, but was perhaps constrained a little bit in terms of the capital usage of their account, or someone who was actively trading other parts of the equity ecosystem, whether it be single stocks, ETFs, CFDs, but futures always provided a little bit of a hurdle for them to get involved, and this just lowers that hurdle in terms of making it more approachable and more accessible for them.
Yeah, personally, I love this. I think this is a really great idea that CME is doing this, because what I really am excited about is the ability for a new trader to come in and to be able to trade a micro product of a product that they want to eventually grow into without having the same tick size as the bigger product. Talk us through some of this product specs on these products.
Sure. So the equity futures that we announced this week, the micro e-minis, they're going to be 1/10 the size of the regular e-mini contract at CME. So that means the e-mini S&P 500 has a $50 multiplier. The micro e-mini S&P 500 will have a $5 multiplier. So they're all going to be 1/10 the size, which makes it much more approachable. To kind of put that in perspective, right now the S&P 500 contract is about $140,000 in terms of contract value of the e-mini. The micro e-mini will be about $14,000 in terms of notional, which will require plus or minus about $700 of initial margin as opposed to $7,000 that the e-mini would. So it really makes it much more approachable. But in terms of how the contract will work, it's going to have the same tick size or the minimum price increment as the e-mini contracts. So we'll look and feel a lot like the existing e-mini market structure and ecosystem. And what I'm excited about this is when we work with not only our retail partner platforms out there, but also all of our liquidity providers in the e-mini contracts, this really will tap into the existing near 24-hour access liquidity of the e-mini contracts, but offer it into the micro e-minis. So it's really availing not only some of the most liquid equity index contracts on the planet to the active individual trading community, it's also offering it to them 24 hours a day, which is something that they don't necessarily find in the cash markets either.
So it's going to mirror the exact time for open and closes and everything as the bigger product.
That's correct. Same trading hours, same tick size, same trading hours, should be relatively the same margin in percentage terms, which we're still finalizing, just 1/10 the size.
Jim, when I was reading about your background, man, was it interesting. Honeywell, CIA, Beltway Bandit Consultants to market maker at the CBOE. Take us through your journey to becoming a trader.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, that course at Purdue actually was pretty much a turning point in my career. I left Purdue, went the typical route, worked as an engineer at Honeywell Avionics in Minneapolis, but all that time, I was fascinated by trading options. And I was more fascinated with the Black-Scholes formula being an engineer. So I actually programmed up the Black-Scholes formula on an Apple IIe. I went from there and I dropped some money in an account at Merrill Lynch and proceeded to lose it all pretty quickly trading options. You could only go long, so basically I just watched the money erode. So from that point I figured, well, if I'm losing this money, somebody else is making it. So I researched how to become a market maker on the CBOE, what it'd take to be on the exchange. And I was newly married, so my wife and I saved our money and got enough money together to come out to Chicago and start trading, start being a market maker on the CBOE.
It's very interesting to me. And talk to me a little bit about
before you became a market maker. I mean, working at the CIA, I know you probably can't share any stories with us. Feel free if you wanted to. But no, I understand that. But talk to me about how much your life has changed, or what you had to go through in changing day-to-day mental thinking to becoming a trader.
Well, the thing I did not understand when I came to the floor of the CBOE was how much self-discipline it actually required. Working in a job, a regular job, I mean, I don't know that day-to-day how much self-discipline actually enters into it. That was probably the biggest change I had to have. I mean, all the time I was working at Honeywell or at CIA or at the Beltway Bandits outside DC, I always was just dreaming of becoming a market maker. It was one of these things that just got under my skin from that class at Purdue, and I wasn't going to let it go.
Yeah, it's amazing. Even someone like you, Jim, you were in the CIA and you're thinking about trading. And that's what happens. Once you trade a little bit, it really is. It's contagious. You just want more of it. What I want to talk a little bit about is you've obviously seen a lot in your career, in your different careers, and you went from being a successful market maker to now owning Connemara Systems. How did you make the decision to go from being a trader, market maker, to then working behind the scenes on trading technology?
Well, there was like these parallel tracks in my life at the time. One was that when I came to the CBOE, the whole idea of financial engineering or using modeling to model prices was really pretty new. But using my engineering background, you know, I was able to do that. And I was continue to write software, because I was an electrical engineer, continue to write software to do financial modeling, position management, all the things that we kind of take for granted today, I was writing on my own. So it wasn't one of these things where it became very natural when I decided to leave the floor after 17 years to just keep writing software. I felt like I had something to offer, and at the time it was right at that critical moment where we were going from transitioning from the floor to electronic trading. So I was kind of at this fortunate place where I knew enough about writing software, but I knew a whole heck of a lot about trading and markets that I could apply it to start this company, Connemara.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account.
What is the role of the CFTC monitoring bad behavior in futures markets? So that's a big part. One of our core missions is to take action against market misbehavior, market manipulation, and fraud. We have a very effective, very active enforcement effort exactly for that purpose. And we also work with our self-regulatory organizations, like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, but also with the National Futures Association, that also work to make sure that our markets are free from fraud, manipulation, and other misconduct. Explain to everybody the difference between the CFTC and the NFA. Great question. So the NFA is a self-regulatory organization. It's set up by market participants and industry participants through their contributions, their dues, in order to police activity in the market. It's not, however, a law enforcement agency. It can impose fines, it can determine misconduct, but at the end of the day, if market participants ignore its instructions, then its job is to refer those cases to us at the CFTC, and we bring in our enforcement action, and we have the ability to bring civil charges and take cases to court. Talk to us about the impact of HFTs in the futures markets. So, you know, our markets have changed dramatically, just like every other part of our lives. You know, every other part of our life has become digitized. Now, I grew up in the 70s. The cars we drove then were pretty analog. They were pretty mechanical, and they really were not electronic. They were not digitized. It took a long time to accelerate, and it took a long time to slow down. But now, modern automobiles are digital. They're fast, they're efficient, they accelerate quickly, and they slow down quickly. And that same digitization is taking place throughout our markets, throughout our entire lives, but especially in our marketplaces. And I liken high-frequency trading to modern automobiles. They're much faster, they're much more efficient, they're much more precise. But under our rules, they have the same right to occupy our highways as the old analog automobiles do. The same rules apply, but they're able to move quick and fast. Now, people have invested to get that quickness and fastness in them, but they have a role to play in the markets. And many would argue that they bring a new degree of liquidity, a new degree of trading capability. Now, for traditional market participants who operate more in a human analog market, it can be very perplexing, this transformation of markets from human to analog, from binary to digital. But it's a transformation we're seeing in markets. And it's a challenge for us as regulators to make sure the principles underlying our regulations still apply in a digital marketplace. How is the CFTC overlooking the HFT spoofing all the market bad behaviors? Is it done through automation? Is it through technology? Is it through people? Is it through people reporting? Is it all of the above? All of the above. So we use many methods of monitoring our market. Some that are very highly automated, but some are simply old-fashioned gumshoeing, and some of them also look to market participants to make us aware of misconduct. So we have whistleblower.gov website where market participants, if they see bad behavior, can go and make us aware of it, and as appropriate, we'll look into that conduct and take action. Your participants, I think your listeners should know, we have been very, very active in monitoring markets. There's been no pause, no let up in our supervision of markets. Under the last 2 years, we've had more enforcement action, we've had more action of large matters, we've had more diversity of matters, we have had more whistleblower awards. We're very, very active on the enforcement front, and I think that the majority, the overwhelming majority of market participants who behave properly in the markets need to know that we're there making sure our markets are free of fraud and manipulation, and we're on the job. 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 And we're on the job.
I want to talk about trading data, because this is a conversation that you and I had on a different call. And we were both talking about how we used to gear up for trading numbers, you know, unemployment or a Fed number. And I used to love trading those days. They were really a big part of my bread and butter for a long period of time.
Bring back those days, I say.
Yeah. Nowadays, and for many years now, I don't know how long it's been, but it's been a while since I've really looked at a number and said, okay, I'm going to trade this right as it comes out. I let the number come out, wait to see what happens. And to me, you said that you do the same thing. Talk to us about how you go about trading data these days.
Yeah. Back 10 years ago, it was so easy, as you mentioned. You didn't need to take a position into the data, particularly in FX, because there's the corporate accounts which leave their bids and offers, and they're not actively trying to generate alpha. They're just doing the business which their underlying business demands. So they're not too fussed about getting the sharp fills which you or I might be looking for. And because of that, and with the advent of electronic trading, you could wait for that data to come out and you could get set at really good prices. And usually once the market had digested that data and your initial read was correct, the market would continue to run in that direction. Now, fast forward 10 years to where we are now, and the algorithms and the systematic guys are a lot quicker and a lot more disciplined in terms of being able to access the markets with their, you know, the flash boys. We've heard about the flash boys being able to get in a lot quicker than you can. Simply, you can't win that race anymore. So we have to evolve. And I think there's two ways to do that. The first is, if we have a good trade setup and we've got data coming out, and it's inevitable that we have data coming out in this day and age. There's usually tier one data coming out every second or third day here in Australia or the US or wherever we might be looking. So we can't avoid data any, we can't avoid data. We can't wait and we can't avoid it. So what I look to do is to take, if I have a high conviction view that this technical setup is worth me taking the risk of running a position into the data, I'll take a small position in. Obviously with a wider stop, because I don't want to get flicked out on some random headline. With employment data, for instance, you get the headline number, and then you get the unemployment rate, then you get the participation rate, and you can get very, very whipsawed around on those types of releases if they don't all come out at once. So I'll look to take a small position in if I have a strong view. And then once that data comes out, I'll wait for the algos to reprice, which usually happens within 4 or 5 seconds, where they think the market should be. After that initial buying comes through, or that initial selling comes through, it then goes quiet for a little while, and the market tends to give back some of its gains. It might not give back all of the gains, and if the data is really strong or really weak, it won't. Most definitely it won't. But I'll be looking for what I call a pullback before the second wave of buying comes in. And that gives me the opportunity to top up on my original position. And that's what I'm looking to do over data now. Because as I said, you can't avoid it. It's made trading for us a little bit more difficult, but there is ways around it.
Yes, yeah, it's extremely interesting, your background, because you went from prop trading to poker to then going back during another really busy time. You seem to keep going back when the times get really busy. And one thing that I'm curious about, because obviously we're going to talk a lot about Wall Street trading today, is how much you compare poker to trading.
Yeah, I think they're really, really similar, because in poker, and you know, the biggest thing that I really loved about poker was that I always felt I had total control. And the same with trading, where you have control whether you're going to get into a position, whether you're going to get out of a position, or the strategy for which different things set you up to take that risk. You know, one of the biggest things I think that poker has taught me over the years is bankroll management. So if that skill alone, if you're able to master that, could take you really far, I think, on the trading side of things. It's really about risk management, and it's really about understanding exactly where you have advantages and where certain things are being presented to you, whether it's on the table and you see a draw that you might want to play against a specific opponent, or you see a setup in a stock that you say, you know what, the probability of this stock either going up on my long or going down on my short is just too much to overlook. And this is what they call a plus EV moment, and you need to take advantage of it.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.